From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics, Zorba, to talk about.
Yes. High heels, are they abnormal or are they normal when it comes to perceiving a woman as sexually attractive?
I have an opinion on that.
I bet you do. And I bet many of the XY genes in our audience have opinions on that, too, as well as the double Xers.
What else?
And while we're on the topic, we're going to talk about Angelina Jolie, her double mastectomy, what it means for people who have the BRCA1 gene or the BRCA2 gene, and actually what it means for women who are worried about breast cancer and have the genetic predisposition.
An interesting and important topic. What's our recipe?
Turkey taco casserole. If you like turkey like I do, and if you like tacos like I do, this is a dynamite recipe that may just be wonderful for your family.
That coming up, 800-462-7413 again is our toll-free number. And Zorba, let's welcome our first caller, a listener with us in Olney, Illinois. Hi.
Greetings from the home of the right squirrel.
how can we help?
I have a two-part question. It has been suggested that swallowing a spoonful or so of yellow table mustard at the start of a leg or foot cramp will eliminate the cramp. So is this a case of mind over matter, or does swallowing the mustard actually get rid of the cramp, and how does that work?
This sounds a little like a medical myth buster to me. Have you ever heard of that, Zorba?
Hey, you know, I don't read everything in the world, so who knows where something like this comes from? So let me ask a question. Is it hot yellow table mustard, like horseradish yellow table mustard, or just plain old regular French's yellow-tasted mustard?
It seems to be the plain old mustard. Five ladies from Olney are taking a 12-week triathlon training class in a neighboring community. So three times a week, we're with a group of ladies biking, swimming, running, or core strength training. And several of the ladies are carrying around yellow bottles of mustard. And they put it next to their yoga mat and put it at the poolside.
I love it.
Packets to their bike stems. They swear by it.
I love it. You know, when they start to get leg cramps, instead of taking water and just squirting water into your mouth, you take mustard and you squirt it in your mouth, too. And you got to be careful to wipe your mouth so it doesn't look like you've got mustard all over you. That is
really they don't want us to spill it in the pool, that's for sure. But they believe that it works, and I have not been that desperate to have to try it. But in case I would, I want to know if I want to suffer through the swallowing the mustard.
There we go. Well, let's look at what I mean, a cramp, you know, we've all had cramps. And when we exercise, we tend to have more cramps. And what we have to do is we've got to move the leg in some way often to get rid of the cramp. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there's no absolute way to keep cramps from happening. We know that stretching beforehand may work, works for some people. We know hydration is an issue. Night cramps are different than exercise cramps. We used to give quinine, and there are people who swear by it and buy it from Canada because we don't manufacture it in the U.S. anymore. But the leg cramps that come with exercise can be really bothersome. And if mustard works, by all means, use it. Now, has there been a double-blind placebo-controlled trial on mustard? I don't think so, and I don't know how you would actually even blind it.
No.
So if it works for these ladies and they swear by it, do it. But I think you hit it on the head when you said it's mind over matter.
Now, let me get this right. You're running, and they have the mustard there, and while they're running, they take the mustard out and squirt it in their mouth and put it back in their pocket or something?
Well, when we run inside on a track, it'll be sitting over by where we put our water bottles. And
gotcha.
I don't know if they carry it with them on the run or if they just take the small packets. But the swim instructor has gone to the extent of keeping a bunch of the small packets in her office as well in case we don't want to use the bottle.
What I'm wondering,
but it's great fun.
Do they stop the exercise and do the mustard and then start again, or is it all going on at the same time?
Well, if you're in the pool, you need to get over to the side of the pool, but you're not walking then.
Yeah. So maybe,
if
maybe
it's next to the yoga mat, you don't have to get up and go get it.
Maybe it's just the stopping on occasion that prevents the cramps.
Maybe, maybe not. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's the mustard. Listen, if it works for you ladies, training for the training that you're doing and the event you're in, by all means use it. And maybe only will lead the world in terms of the reduction of cramps with mustard.
Why don't you do your own double blind and some of you use ketchup?
Okay, we'll try it.
All right, thanks for the call.
A lot.
Thank you very much.
Mustard ketchup. Yeah. Mustard ketchup.
800-462-7413.
We could also do horseradish and wasabi and see whether or not that makes a difference.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And a listener now, Zorba, in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I was calling about a question about passion fruit juice. I have heard that that is a light sedative and can help you sleep. And we have a 10-month-old granddaughter who just doesn't like to sleep. And I was just wondering if that would be a safe thing to use for her. Or if not, would you have a recommendation for a natural sleep aid for her?
You know, when it comes to sleep, you try everything. You know, the old English remedy of warm milk is something that was touted for many years. They did a study of it and actually showed that warm milk may actually be worthwhile in helping people sleep throughout the night, a little glass of warm milk. Mm-hmm. So I would try the fresh passion fruit and see if it works, you know, see whether or not it does something. It's a rather sweet drink, but I would see what it is. I wouldn't give a lot of it because then you might have to get up and go to the washroom during the night. But I would try 4 to 6 ounces. No study that I know about it. Now, have you tried anything else with her?
Not really, because I guess we just don't want to medicate her, so to speak. But we were just wondering, we had heard about passion fruit juice and it had been used on children in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I would try it. I would try and see. You know, one of the problems with things like this is that, you know, there's myths that float around, gee, it works, or it's just anecdotal. Mm-hmm. Worked for my daughter because my daughter's sleeping and your daughter isn't. But I think I would try it. You're right. By the way, not to medicate. You don't want to medicate and get into a whole medication thing for sleep. What time does she go to sleep, by the way? Just want to know that a bit.
Probably on average in the evening, somewhere between 7:30 and 8:30.
And what time do you want her to get up?
Well, she usually gets up around 6.
Okay, so 7:30 to 6, you know, so you're talking about 10 and a half hours of sleep. Maybe that's...
No, but she doesn't sleep the whole time.
Well, maybe she's, but maybe she should go to sleep later. Maybe that's too early for her. Maybe she ought to go to sleep at 9 o'clock or 9:30 and do things in between. I mean, that may be just too much. She may be getting fragmented sleep because she's simply in bed too long. So I'd knock off an hour. In other words, I'd immediately go to an 8:30 sleep time.
Just try to assume her sleep pattern is going to be shorter than average.
I'd go to 8:30. That's what I would do. I'd say, you've got an 8:30 sleep pattern. We're going to try it for a month or 6 weeks. Don't do it for a week. It's not going to work to reset that biological clock. Give it a month, a good month. And then you want to make sure everything in the bedroom is good. The bed clothes that she has, is it too hot or too cold? You know, is the comforter too heavy or too light? Is the room quiet? Is it dark? But, you know, all those things that are important. In fact, we'll put a link on our website, zorbapastor.org, for good sleep hygiene. So we'll put a link on there. I'll find a good article on the web and connect it
and
there.
And you want to leave passion fruit in this mix?
I try passion fruit. I put her to sleep later, and I try some passion fruit. Hey, it could be – there's also the ritual of going to sleep. I'm going to go to sleep now, have my passion fruit, sit, you know. And sometimes ritual makes a difference with sleep too. We all – many of us have sleep rituals. We brush our teeth. Some of us take our pills. We get into bed. We read. We ritualize sleep because it seems to work better. Good luck. Later sleep time, try the passion fruit. Let us know. And as I said, we'll link the sleep hygiene to our site.
Thank you very much.
Sure. You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Maybe passion fruit eases cramps when you're running.
We're not going to give her a teaspoon of mustard before she goes to sleep. That's for sure.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. So, Zorba, some research on women wearing high heels.
Oh, I think this is very important research. Yeah. Actually, when you look at the number of women wearing high heels, you can just see. So this was a very important, excellent article published in Evolution and Human Behavior, looking at judgments about women wearing high heels. High heels, and how do they actually affect? And the participants viewed videos of women wearing two types of shoes. One were flats, one were women in high heels. And lo and behold, the women in high heels were judged as more attractive, as increased femininity. They also noticed that their stride length was decreased. In other words, they didn't have as long a gait, but they also had an increased rotation and tilt of the hips.
Yeah. This it just, might be this that just the, in?
This just
we need
in.
Research to this, tell us this.
Justin, I don't know who funded the research. This just in, but increased rotation and tilt of the hips. So remember, this is the Journal of Evolution and Human Behavior. So, and they were judged to be more attractive, sex specific, more attractive when they were in high heels. So I think that we can say that beyond a shadow of a doubt, scientifically, that women who wear high heels. Yeah. Are judged more attractive, and it's worked the ankle injuries and foot injuries that accompany the high heels.
Yeah, worth it, you say?
Well, I mean that's the question. That's the question. In the eye of the beholder.
Did you notice that our producer Gabrielle Pedriani is wearing high heels?
I have. I've noticed that her high heels are sometimes they appear to be 3 inches high, but I asked her. I said, "How can you wear those high heels and walk?" And she says, "Well, it's just what you learn to do." Have you ever tried to walk in high heels, Tom? I have around the house in high heels.
Okay.
You know what?
It's Zorba tells
it's
all.
Really, The next show.
Not a serious note.
Yes.
This attractiveness may not be worthwhile once the woman is a 40, 50, 60 years
or
old.
Or what about if...
What are the long-term effects of
Well, you know what? We
heels.
Just have to do another study to find what the... You're talking about long-term effects on the woman's foot. Well,
yes.
We know that high heels cause bunions.
That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. They cause bunions. So you have to tell an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20, 24-year-old woman, don't wear those high heels. You're going to get bunions. And guess what they'll say?
So what? I'm not.
That's right. So what? Thank you very much. That's exactly it. But if you look at the age, often women don't wear high heels that much, especially after they're of a certain age. Oh. They may just wear them to go out, but
I think whatever age,
day.
There are lots fewer women in high heels now than there were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Well, that might be the case, Tom. But what may also be the case, Tom, is that you are older and you are not necessarily aware of how many women are in high heels. Is that a possibility?
No, it isn't.
Tom tells all.
1-800-FORCE. I've never seen you in high heels. 1-800-FORCE.
And you never will.
1-800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. On we go to Bloomington, Indiana now. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I had a question about the connection between seasonal allergies and dairy consumption, because for me personally, I've noticed a difference between when I'm consuming a lot more dairy, my allergies have seemed a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know exactly why that could be, or I've had trouble convincing other people of why I decided to go dairy-free for my allergies. So I was curious what you guys thought about it.
Uh-huh. So do you have food allergies or seasonal allergies, sniffy, sneezy?
No, it's not food allergies at all.
Uh-huh. I don't know if there's any connection there at all, but I can tell you there's a connection to dairy and how we process dairy. So there's a gene that developed in Northern Europe about 10,000 years ago. To allow us to basically absorb lactose throughout our life. And it was a gene that developed seriously in Northern Europe, and that's when they started taking cows, herdsmen started producing milk, dairy products, and cheese. It's very, very common about Northern Europeans to be able to digest lactose. But as you move, we'll say, more towards Asia and more towards the southern part of Africa, that tends to disappear. And so a lot of adults are lactose intolerant to a small extent or to a large extent. So it's possible that when your body is stressed with allergies, you could possibly have some lactose intolerance. I mean, if I try to think this through scientifically, and that's actually producing, you know, the increased allergy type symptoms. Then you've got the other side. You have complementary and alternative medicine, which says lactose causes more mucus. When you have dairy products, you produce more mucus. There have been a number of scientific studies that have shown that's not the case. But then you have anecdotal information that people say, hey, I know it's not the case, but it's the case for me. And when you look at
how I feel about the situation. I guess.
Well, when you look at science, it's a population. But when you look at an individual, it's one after another. So as many people, you know, can't differentiate individual differences. So you're dairy-free during certain months. Is that it?
Well, I mean, I just have decided recently to go dairy-free because there was actually a few years where I was basically vegan almost and, like, didn't have hardly any allergies at all, it seemed like.
Uh-huh.
And then recently, I actually work at a French restaurant now, so my dairy consumption has skyrocketed.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
This year my allergies were way worse than they've been in a while. So I feel like maybe that was the connection. And so I decided to go dairy-free for a little while, for like a couple weeks, and it has definitely helped.
Uh-huh. So you're going to switch to working at a different restaurant, go to a vegan restaurant instead of the French restaurant?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I could do that. It was really hard to be dairy-free at the French restaurant, but it did help. So it was good motivation. I'm not going to be dairy-free all the time.
I only dairy-free during certain months when your allergies bother you. But, you know, people do a lot of different things during allergy season. They turn on the air conditioner. They may put ionizers in their house to get rid of the dust. They will take antihistamines. Before good antihistamines and nasal sprays came out, and I suffered from allergies, I did a whole bunch of things to try to keep down my allergies. I never tried going dairy-free, but I think it works for you. Do it. And like you said, it's hard to eat French food without the dairy.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in College Station, Texas. Hi.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Yes. I was had a question. About 3 years ago, this started. It's kind of a nuisance. When I go in the sun and I get a sunburn, I end up getting rash. You know, I grew up in South Florida, been in the sun most of my life, you know, a lot of hobbies in the sun, and it's just something that just started happening over the last, like, 3 years, like I said. And it kind of has a delay thing. I don't get a rash, like, instantly from being in the sun, but maybe a few hours later, you know, go take a shower, you know, say I've been at the beach, and then I'll rash up almost like a heat rash.
So this has gone on last year, half year, say a couple of years this has gone on now?
Yeah, about 3 years. Uh-huh. Yeah, it started just out of nowhere,
sure.
Just one summer.
How long does the rash last when you get it?
Usually a few hours to, you know, sometimes even I'll go to bed and it'll still be there.
Uh-huh.
Usually by the time I wake up, it's gone away.
So is it a bright red rash, sort of where the sun was?
It's usually in the same places every time, no matter where I get sun.
Uh-huh. So now, is it there any difference at the beginning of the season or the end of the season? In other words, where when you first get out in the sun and you start to tan, that makes a difference versus later on?
Definitely. I think it does, yeah.
Do you think it could be a heat rash instead of a sun rash?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I would think. But, you know, everything I've looked, you know, no one has been able to tell me anything about what they think it is.
Yeah. I think it's more likely, well, first of all, a heat rash is when we're overheated. I mean, that's what we think of.
Yeah.
And we're sweating and sometimes we don't have enough water or the sweat glands pour off. And we've all had it, and you can picture that in a baby, and they have it. But people do have different sun reactions. Are you on any pills at all, any medications?
No.
No medicines. No antibiotics. Antibiotics can do it. A whole variety of blood pressure pills can also do it. And some people are basically become hypersensitive to the sun. We almost call it an allergy, but it's not really an allergy. It's really a hypersensitivity reaction to the sun itself. So one of the things you can do when you have it, if it bothers you, is actually put on some sort of a sunscreen. That probably is going to make a difference because you won't have as many UVA and UVB rays that are doing doing that, and you want to take one that's UVA, UVB, that also has some zinc in it, because it really does make a difference. I tried that out and see if that makes a difference too. And once again, these reactions to the sun can occur after a number of years. Like you said, you could be in the sun and do sun sports, but as you get older, our bodies change. So that's probably it.
Thank you very much. I will try that.
You're welcome. Great. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Appreciate the call. Now, before a quick break, Zorba, let's gear up for another round of Judge Zorba. Today we have a question from Kelvin in Detroit, Michigan. He writes, "Hi, Zorba. As a busy father of two troublemaking teen boys, your show is my go-to for no-nonsense advice. Recently, my 18-year-old son started trying to beef up. I think we both know a girl's involved here somewhere. I want to know, is there any danger of eating too much protein? Between the egg whites, protein powder, and lean meat, I'm worried he might be overdoing the bulk. He obviously thinks he's invincible, but what do you think? Does he have more to worry about than his next date?"
Well, first of all, at 18, you are invincible. That's exactly it. That's what you're supposed to think at 18. You know, at 18, you got a good body, you've got a good kidney, you don't have to worry about too much protein. Now, people who have a kidney disease who try to bulk up at 60 or 70 or 80, mm-hmm. who have reduced glomerular filtration of the kidney, as it's called, they can have problems with protein. But at 18, it's not going to produce any problem at all. And frankly, as long as he takes his protein and exercises, which is how you really bulk up, I think it's just fine. And that may make him more attractive or just may make him feel better.
So your decision is for?
My decision is for the kid. Go for it.
Do you need a pro to help your teen? Just send your Judge Zorba cases along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. It's a good one. Lots more of your calls. Our medical myth buster too. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We'll be getting back to the phones after we do our recipe, which is right now, turkey taco casserole.
Yes, turkey taco casserole. Try saying that 10 times and see what's happening.
Turkey taco casserole. Turkey taco. That isn't that hard.
I like Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, that kind of a thing. Yeah. You like turkey?
I like turkey.
You like tacos?
Not so much.
Well, I don't feel like this casserole.
You asked.
I asked, right? Asked, and I'll get. Do you like okra?
No.
Well, there's no okra in this recipe. How about tofu? Do you like tofu?
I was saying, what is it going to throw at me now?
So this is not okra. Okay. This is not tofu. This is turkey and
then
taco.
Then I'm going to love it.
Right.
Keep the okra.
That's exactly it. I kept okra out of this recipe, so you're going to have a great time.
Let's do it.
Okay. Start out with 1 pound of lean or extra lean ground turkey. And this is important. A lot of ground turkey is dark meat. You really want to have ground turkey that may have a little dark meat, but some light meat, and you want it to say lean or extra lean.
Yeah, pound lean or extra lean ground turkey.
Yeah, because otherwise you're getting pretty much almost the same amount of fat as you would in a burger.
Yeah.
1/2 cup of onion chopped.
1/2 cup of chopped onion.
1/2 green pepper chopped.
1/2 green bell pepper chopped.
1 tablespoonful of taco seasoning mix.
Big T, taco seasoning mix.
Now, a bit about that. If you use taco seasoning mix like I do, choose the best one that you like. I went to the store once years ago, got a number of packets. They come in little packets. Found the one that I liked. Then I use Penzi Spice, which I like a lot. Mm-hmm. And they're a great spice shop. But buy them in small packets because over time, they kind of lose their flavor. Don't buy a large jar unless you're going to be doing this all the time.
You don't have tacos that often.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
When my kids were younger, we had many more tacos. Yeah. But now we don't as much. Mm-hmm. A teaspoon of chili powder.
Little tea chili powder.
And this is chili powder that we use in making chili. You know, not hot butter.
Yeah.
1 tablespoonful of ground cumin.
Big tea, ground cumin.
1 1/4 teaspoons of salt.
1 1/4 little tea salt.
1/4 teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
1/4 little tea cayenne pepper.
And you would add more of that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would.
You'd put in like
I like it spicy.
You'd put in a tablespoonful of cayenne.
Well, I don't know.
It's a little bit hot.
Seems a little, yeah.
A little overdoing it, but it could throw you over the edge. You know, live a little. Put in more cayenne pepper.
Yeah.
15-ounce can of fire-roasted diced tomatoes, drained.
15-ounce can of fire-roasted diced tomatoes. What's that? What's
you buy them in they're tomatoes. They used to just be diced, and now because they're cooked, they're fire-roasted. I have no idea how they do it, except when you open up the can, the tomatoes, some of them are sort of blackened, and they have a different
spicy?
Taste. No, they're not necessarily spicy. You know what? They're kind of charred.
Oh.
They're charred. And you know what? They're dynamite. If you've never used fire-roasted diced tomatoes in a recipe, go for it. That's the only tomato. That's my go-to tomato now that I use for everything.
Oh, really? That's good info. Okay.
1 16-ounce can of low-sodium black beans. They're pretty much all low-sodium.
A 16-ounce can of low-sodium black beans?
Yeah. 3/4 cup of cheddar cheese. If you can get the low-fat, use that. That's the best.
3/4 cup of maybe low-fat cheddar cheese.
3 low-carb tortillas cut into strips. And you can get whole wheat tortillas that are low carb. Mm-hmm. They're made differently. A whole bunch of tortillas. Once again, try them out. Find out one you like.
3 of them. Low carb tortillas cut into strips.
And 1/3 cup of salsa. Choose what you wish.
1/3 cup of salsa.
Let's make the recipe. Mm-hmm. Preheat the oven to 375 degrees. Then spray a large skillet, a nonstick skillet if you can, with nonstick cooking spray. And when you spray it with this and you use a nonstick skillet, you're basically reducing hidden fat in your diet, which are calories. 1 tablespoon of fat is 100 calories and often calories that you do not need. Mm-hmm. So whatever you can do to get rid of fat always works. Place it over medium heat, and once it's hot, add the ground turkey, brown it, and put in the onion. Brown it with the onion, breaking up the bits and pieces. Then add the green pepper after the turkey is cooked and the onion is cooked. And when it's browned, hasn't cooked all the way through, add the taco seasoning. Mm-hmm. So just before it's totally browned so it can suck up the taco seasoning, chili powder, the cumin, the salt, and the cayenne pepper, and mix it well. Pretty typical way that we make a casserole. Mm-hmm. Then when it's all finished, add the fire-roasted tomatoes because you don't really want to cook them. Stirring it just a little bit when you're cooking them. You don't want to cook them nearly done to remove a little bit of the moisture. And then decide how soupy you want to have it. I often just kind of warm it up when I'm using them, but some people want it drier, and that's when you decide it. Then spray an 8-ounce square casserole pan with nonstick cooking spray. Spread a thin layer of the turkey mixture on the bottom of the pan. Top it with 1/3 of the beans. And by the way, when you use the low-sodium beans, make sure you wash them in a colander beforehand to remove sort of the moisture that's around there. They'll taste better. Sprinkle 1/4 of the cheese on top, 1 of the tortillas worth of strips, and then repeat the process 2 times. So you're making it into a nice layered casserole with the strips. Spread the salsa over the top along with a little bit of cheese. Place pan in the oven for 30 minutes. When done, let the casserole cool for about 10 to 20 minutes before slicing. If you serve it with low-fat Greek yogurt or low-fat sour cream, if you put on hot sauce, if you put on a sliced avocado, you will get raves from your guest and your family.
I do like Southwest food, Mexican food.
Yeah,
I just don't like tortillas that much.
Well, but the tortillas are the crunch that you're putting in here. That's really what they're. But you could make without the tortilla.
Yeah,
you could do this. There's no reason you have to have the tortilla.
Yeah, I tend to do enchiladas rather than tortillas because it's soft and I like
so
that.
You like,
I don't like to pick it up and it spills all out.
Yeah, it's messy. You're such a clean person. You're always looking for messy stuff.
If I want this recipe, if only there was somewhere I could find it.
Now, let me think. Where could you possibly go? Now, you could go, I think, to zorbapastor.org. I bet you could find that recipe. I bet you could go through the archives and find other recipes. I bet you could find pictures of yourself and me. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Attica, Indiana. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
How are you?
Fine.
Well, my problem is my husband's growing problem, literally. He has a bunion and has had a bunion for a long time, decades. And I guess I've bugged him enough about it that and have for many years that about 10 years ago he went to a specialist.
Uh-huh.
The specialist told him to just wait as long as he could stand the pain until he did something about it. And since that time, he has developed a, I guess they're called hammer toes, mm-hmm. which is the adjacent toe to the big toe because mm-hmm. of the pressure, I assume, from that large toe pushing into it. He now has pain and swelling underneath that second toe. And I guess I have several questions then regarding the bunion. And the first one is, I'm not real pleased with this specialist for suggesting that he let this go until my husband can't stand the pain. I don't know if my husband's just so stubborn he puts up with the pain or what, but now he has a malformed second toe. And then another question I have is the only way to correct this with surgery? Because mm-hmm. we've heard horror stories mm-hmm. about bunion surgery.
Uh-huh.
And another question I have is actually coming from my husband, mm-hmm. who after I told him I was going to call mm-hmm. Dr. Zorba uh-huh. and ask him his opinion, he told me to ask you your advice on how much nagging a husband should take from his wife on health issues.
Now, that's a good question.
That's a good question. That's a good question. You know, I'm going to get out my gavel for that question, and I'm going to answer that when we're done. So, first of all, let's talk about the specialist. Mm-hmm. You're right. That was the wrong specialist. I mean, that is ridiculous. You know, live with your bunions until you can't stand the pain? I mean, where did this person come from? I mean, that is definitely the wrong person to go to. And, you know, we've talked about the fact that gut bunions come from high heels, and I expect that your husband was not wearing high heels as a cause of the bunions, but it's because they do happen in men, too. Mm-hmm. Not just as in women. As for horror stories, you know what? Bunion surgery is painful. That's for sure. Because what they do is they break the bone. Mm-hmm. They put it back together. They may put a rod in there too. Very, very successful in the right hands. It is painful for a number of days. And we have wonderful technology. They're called painkillers. And you take your painkillers, you stay at home, you put your leg up, and you don't do much for a couple of weeks. That's what you do. And as far as horror stories, I send people for bunion surgery all the time. And what they say is, it was painful, it hurt, I got through it, and now I'm much better. So I don't want to, you know, sugarcoat it and say it's pain-free. It is not. And what kind of surgery? Well, you want to go to a surgeon who does lots of bunions. Okay. Number one, I wouldn't go back to this guy under any conditions who said, wait a few years. He's out of the picture, right?
Yeah, he is.
He's out of the picture. But what I would do is I would find an orthopedic surgeon or a podiatrist who does lots of bunion surgery. Now, podiatrists are specialists in the feet, and that's all they do. And we have in our medical group, I'm part of a large medical group, some of our orthopedic surgeons do bunion surgery, but frankly, it's mostly through our podiatrists. So my recommendation is find someone who you think is good, who other people may recommend. And if you're unsure, go in, just like you search for a car, search for a surgeon for this. Go to one or two places. Definitely get it done. There's no doubt about it. I think it's worthwhile. Now, on to the second question.
Yes.
How much nagging should a husband take before he tells his wife not to call and talk to him about it anymore? And I'm going to come down fair and square for the Well, I have to be careful about this.
Maybe yes, I should do. Because you know who's on married. The phone right now.
You know what? There are some questions that I just can't answer. I am putting my gavel away, and I'm going to say that is beyond my expertise. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you. I'll tell him.
There you go.
Yeah, right. Good luck with it, too. 800-462-7413.
You know, sometimes you have to know when to be silent.
Mm-hmm. When to hold them and when to fold them. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take a question from Renata in Lake Tomahawk, Wisconsin. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, recently I found out that I'm allergic to penicillin, which I know is made from mold. Now, I'm worried that my favorite stinky cheeses, like Roquefort and Lindenberger, will cause the same effect. Do I have to worry about a side effect other than the embarrassing smell?"
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, if you're allergic to penicillin, it's very specific for penicillin. And people who have a penicillin or an amoxicillin allergy are not allergic to mold and cheese. She can eat all the stinky cheese she wants to, and she'll be just fine.
Oh, so good. Good.
Good luck. Yeah. I love stinky cheese, too, and I think it's really tasty, but one must be careful.
Have a problem for Zorba to sniff out? Just send your questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk over. That's coming up. More of your calls, of course, our medical Mythbuster 2, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We're back to the phones at 1-800-462-7413 in a little while. But first, Zorba, Angelina Jolie's double mastectomy made big news a while ago for a lot of really good reasons.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, she announced it. She could have kept it private, and she did exactly the opposite. And I, you know, kudos to her for doing it. There are some people that came out and said, well, wait a minute, she's going to do it, so there are going to be too many women asking for double mastectomies. I think it's great because all of a sudden there's a discussion about this and a discussion about whether or not, you know, it should be done. But let's look at some of the reasons that she added. So there's the BRCA1 and BRCA2, BRCA1 and BRCA2. These are breast cancer suppression gene number one and number two. They discovered it. It's a gene that suppresses the tendency to produce breast cancer. Women who have the gene and who develop breast cancer have harder to treat breast cancer because it does not respond to hormonal therapies, and the tumors are more likely to, you know, to actually develop in the breast if you've got the gene.
Something like 82 or some percent.
Well, it turns out that roughly 12% of all women will develop breast cancer in their lives. So it's a common cancer that occurs. A number of those women are going to perish from breast cancer. A lot of the women get caught very, very early and do not have problems because we have modern techniques such as removing the tumor and then hormonal techniques. But when we look at the BRCA gene, we find the risk of breast cancer is much, much higher, and then the risk that you'll die from breast cancer is much, much higher. And I think that's the issue. And it's not just breast cancer. It's also ovarian cancer that is also increased with the gene. And so the issue comes, who should be screened for the gene? Because the genetic test is very expensive.
Mm-hmm. It's not who should?
Well, women who have an increased risk of breast cancer in their family. So let's say, for instance, a mother and a mother's sister has breast cancer. So let's say there are two women, first-degree relatives who have it. Let's say it's a mother and a grandmother had it. So like my grandmother had it, my mother had it, should I be screened? That puts you at an increased risk that you might have it. Or a couple of first-degree relatives, mother and sisters, who have had ovarian cancer. And there's no absolute yes or no or who should be screened. It's something that really is discussed with the doctor, often with the geneticist. And then the decision is, well, I've got the gene, what do I do then?
Yeah. What I really liked about this is when she announced this, she said, this in no way affects my femininity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wonderful. Wonderful. And we know that Angelina Jolie is the paradigm of femininity in America. I mean, she's one of the most beautiful women around. She's a movie star. And she came out and basically said, it's okay to have your breasts removed for this. You're still a woman. You're still attractive. You're still feminine. And that's the bottom line message.
1-800-462-7413, toll free. To the phones again now, Zorba, a Sacramento, California listener with us. Hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking my question.
Yeah, we appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, I'm wondering what Dr. Zorba thinks of hair analysis as a way to determine the state of one's health, and how accurate does he feel the results are.
Uh-huh. So did you have a hair analysis?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh. And that was from a naturopath or homeopath?
Yes, and it was sent to some lab in Arizona to be.
Tell me what the result was.
I got this huge booklet with my results, and of course I was low in basically every nutrient and mineral known to man.
Okay. And how much, if I may ask, how much did the hair analysis cost?
I think it was about $100 to $150.
Okay, $100 to $150. And then when you got the results, tell me what your naturopath wanted to do at that point.
Oh, to sell me supplements to alleviate these problems.
Right. And how much?
I think
how much,
where this is going.
How much?
That was about another $100.
So when we look at it, and I think that's always important, it costs $100 or $150 for a test. I don't find that much. You know, I think if you want to get an analysis, we'll talk about the science behind it later. I think $100 or $150 a month. I mean, I go to my massage therapist, and I may pay $60 for my massage, so you know I'm going to pay $100 or $150. That's discretionary income. But then I say, well, you need all of these things, and I can sell them to you, and they're prepackaged, and this is where you get them, and they cost $100 a month. Well, then you're talking about $1,200 a year. You know, after 10 years, it's $12,000. And I think the important issues here is hair does not demonstrate what's going on in your body. When you go to an allopathic doctor, that's me, regular doctor, you get a blood test, runs through a machine, and then we know the things that we measure, like sodium and potassium and creatinine and cholesterol, they correspond to biological processes in the body that are associated with disease. We know that. That's why we test these chemicals. Hair doesn't do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's dead, and you put it in, and they do some analysis of elements and say you need this element and that element, but there's no science behind it. It's anecdotal information, and it costs money.
Okay, so bottom line is the hair is already dead, and therefore it's not giving you an accurate analysis of your health.
Right. Now, there are some things, such as lead levels, and we used to do hair analyses for lead levels. We don't do that anymore. You basically do blood tests. But there's some things that I remember from my distant past. I think it was lead that are deposited in hair. But no, you can do an analysis, but it doesn't correspond to disease. So, you know, you go and do the analysis. It corresponds to money in the pocket of the naturopath. So you can see what I think about it. So.
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
Yes. But that's okay.
Okay,
you know,
well,
that's...
thank you very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much for the call. Zorba time again now for our medical myth buster. We know that many life metaphors come from the saying...
Wait a second. Life metaphors? Now, this is a philosophical discussion.
Well,
Of course. Our show is the philosophy show.
We're trying to class it up a little bit.
Yeah, life metaphor.
Come from the saying that it causes less pain to remove a Band-Aid quickly than slowly. But is it true? Does a quick rip really reduce the suffering?
So for the answer for this, medical mythbuster, I went to Australia because we know that Well, we know that the guys there are sissies when it comes to removing the Band-Aids. But I think of Australians, don't you think of virile men who are out there, you know, fighting alligators?
I, I don't tend to think about Australian men that much, I guess.
No, I've got a friend. I've been to Australians. You know, they're a man's man. They're guys' guys.
Okay.
So they got a number of medical students, male medical students and female medical students in a study. Now, first of all, it turned out that men on the whole found the removal of Band-Aids much more painful than women. I want you to know that. The guys had much more pain than the girls when it came to it. They complained much more than the women, and this was statistically significant. So the take-home message, of course, is that. But it was true. There were two things that were true. When you remove the Band-Aid quickly, it was less painful than you removed it slowly. But here's the problem. It depended on who did the removal. In other words, it was operator dependent. So some people removed the Band-Aid and it hurt more because of the way they removed the Band-Aid, either quickly or slowly. So in other words, quick is better, but how you do it is better. So maybe one person got in and said, I'm just going to rip it off and and ripped it off. Somebody said, I'm going to remove it quickly, and then they removed it nicely. But remember, the guys were – they complained more than
the girls. I wonder if removing it yourself as opposed to having someone else remove it.
Well, they didn't actually test that. It was an operator that a trained bandage remover.
Australia. What kind of school do you need?
That's right. Maybe you get a degree of specialty in bandage removals when it comes to that. You know, it's Australia. It's a different culture. They speak like us, but they've got an accent.
Have a myth to remove? We promise it'll be quick and painless. Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. I had my wife remove my Band-Aids.
No.
Of course. She kisses it before she removes it, and then it doesn't hurt at all.
1-800-462-7413. It's a toll-free number, and a Milwaukee, Wisconsin listener joins in now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
I have an exercise question. I run about 3 to 4 times a week for about 30 to 40 minutes, which is very beneficial. But for me, it takes too much time. And I read an article in the New York Times about a 7-minute workout that provides the same benefits as a 30-minute workout. And knowing that you don't get something for nothing, I'm curious about what might be missing from such a short workout.
Uh-huh. Well, the rest of the workout is the first thing about that's certainly missing. So, in other words, in 7 minutes, you'll get the same benefit as 30 minutes. Now, how old are you?
46.
46. What do you want to get out of workout? What are you interested in doing?
Well, I get three things. For the heart benefits, the sense of well-being, and calorie burning. And I would have probably passed on this article, except it has references to actual research, references a journal that published these findings.
Sure, sure.
And I've done this workout a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to provide at least the well-being benefits. It doesn't have that meditative effect you get from long running.
What do you do in that 7 minutes?
Oh, there's 12 exercises. So it's 30 seconds with a 10-second rest between each exercise.
Uh-huh. So let's look at the specific things you're getting for. First of all, you're getting well-being from a 7-minute workout. And 7 minutes, if you get some sense of well-being in 7 to 10 minutes, that is better than nothing. I mean, so you've got to compare that in that place. So I think there is a place for people who do nothing to do something 7 minutes a day. And if you do it 7 minutes a day, you know, if at the end of the week, you're going to get at least an hour of exercise. And for people who get nothing, I think that's worthwhile. From a cardiac point of view, you're not going to do much. We know that the cardiac basically is 20 minutes a day, 3 to 4 days a week, at least, at about 80% of your maximal heart rate to be able to get aerobic benefits. 7 minutes, you're not going to get much from a cardiac point of view. From a balance point of view, which is very important as we get older, you're probably going to get a little something from 7 minutes because you're moving around if you're doing some balance exercises. And from a strength point of view, you may get a little bit in 7 minutes. Now, you bring up a very interesting point. Quote, it's published in journal and their findings. So there are good journals and junk journals. And there are more and more junk journals around than there are good journals. The vast majority of the journals, if you just looked at it globally, are garbage. And kind of look with a jaundiced eye at journals and say, is it real or not real? 7 minutes, Not much. So I wouldn't trade my 30-minute or 45-minute workout for a 7-minute workout unless maybe I was traveling. I'm traveling, can't do much, I'm too busy, I'm going to do my 7 minutes. That's where it's going to be useful. And I'll tell you, I travel a lot, and when I travel, I often don't do any workout. If I had a 10-minute workout, I bet I would do it more, you know, when I'm traveling. And often when I'm traveling, I'm not doing nearly as much as I should. I'm often doing nothing. So does that help you?
Yeah, that's very helpful. I might mix that in with my regular workout.
Correct.
But yes, doesn't sound like the whole thing, is using that as my
workout
plan would be a good idea.
And, you know, all of a sudden you gave me an idea. Why not do a regular workout 3 days a week? And instead of doing nothing and resting on your derriere the other 4 days a week, maybe do a 7 to 10 minute workout. Do it in the morning so it sort of gets you going. And maybe that's a good way to kind of use it. Mix and match. It's not A or B. It's A and B. Now, burning calories, it's just the attenuation of appetite that a workout does. If you're full speed on a treadmill, 30 minutes, 80% of your capacity, you're not even burning a Big Mac. So in other words, even though we think we're burning calories, our bodies are super efficient. We always have to reduce food intake if we really want to take off the weight.
Okay.
Good
Great.
Luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for bringing this up. Interesting thing.
And before we head out, Zorba, let's take an interesting question from a listener who's looking to add a little kick to his morning smoothie. Aaron in Milwaukee, Wisconsin writes, "Dear Dr. Z, a while ago, I saw a sign at my local pharmacy that read, 'We can flavor your medications.' I asked the pharmacist if he could flavor my medicine to taste like scotch, beer, or wine."
That's funny.
"But he said that he could only do fruit flavors. Now, suddenly, I had an idea. If one small glass of red wine is good for my daily health, could I pour the wine into my blender instead of the few ounces of water I usually add? If it all goes to the same place, would blending the Burgundy ruin its effects?"
No, I think that would be just fine. It all depends on whether or not you want to have that glass of wine earlier in the day so that it changes your mind. I mean, I'm wine sensitive. If I have a glass of wine in the morning, I'm not very good
for
the
rest of the
day.
So you aren't going to take it with your morning medication?
I am not taking it with my morning medication. It does not attenuate the effects. But now, what if you take your what about noon? You know, the French have a glass of wine, even the teachers in the school, at noon. So maybe you take it with your noon medication. But
not a bad idea.
No, you could blend it with coffee if you want to. Blend it with your caffeine. I think it's just fine.
Do you want to spike your smoothie? Just send your questions and drink recipes along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, by the way, you can find us on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show is produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo Ann Van Sidrin. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping for your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0608Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.